sometimes behave so strangely. Hello and welcome to another episode of the So Strangely podcast, now in season two. As part of season two, I've decided to change up the process a little, and I'm bringing you some papers that I personally find very interesting and want to highlight. So today, we'll be talking about a paper by Alex Demos, Dr. Alex Demos, a clinical assistant professor at the University of Illinois Chicago, written with Roger Chaffin from the University of Connecticut. And it was called How Music Moves Us and Training to Musicians' Movements, recently published in Music Perception. So Alex, thank you for joining me and coming on to talk about your work.
Great. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, so I'm going to try to give a summary of this paper, and Alex, please catch me, correct me as I go along if I misrepresent anything. So the experiment was using motion capture measurements of trombonists and listeners to the performances of the trombonists as they were air conducting along to the music. And air conducting is kind of in quotes, and I'll let you explain what you mean by air conducting. And what you were looking at, as I understand it, was alignment or synchrony of measurement between the performers and the listeners when the listeners only had access to the audio of the trombonist's performance. So the physical motion of the trombonists and the physical motion by the listeners. And using some very interesting analysis techniques that we will get way into later, I'm so excited, you found that there was actually significant alignment between these performers and listeners in how they engaged with the shared musical signal, both at a metrical level, but then beyond, and that there was a connection also between the trombonists' physical motions as they later listened to and recreated these performances. What you're getting at here, as I understand it, is a very fundamental issue for music performance and production science, which is capturing intermittent synchrony between people sharing a musical signal and differentiating it statistically from incidental alignment that can happen between any kind of, you know, continuous measurements. And this is such a fascinating challenge from a data analysis perspective, as well as a really important thing for us to work out so as to actually get out the synchrony that is possible in our musical behaviors. Alex, does that fairly represent what you were getting at in this paper?
Yes. So the real challenge is as you describe it, is trying to parse what it is that when a listener is hearing music, what information about motion are they getting from mm-hmm. the sounds that they're receiving? Mm-hmm. So there's metrical level, there's, you know, the musical beat providing some basis, as well as what I think is information about the performers' movements themselves.
All right. Let's maybe go back to the beginning here. Where did this project come from?
Right. So it has kind of a long history. It started when I was a music student in high school. I was taking lessons with a very good performer, and I'm a violinist. So this violin teacher I had, she used to leave me to go practice, and she'd say, practice this section. And then she'd walk out of the room. Mm-hmm. And then I'd hear her yell, stop swaying so much. And I'd look, she's nowhere near me, right? She's not seeing me. Then I would hear her scream again, no, up bow, not down bow, and no, towards the frog, not towards the tip. She was hearing me, and because her ear was so much sharper than mine, she was able to hear as I moved around the room and around my instrument, and she knew what I was doing.
Yeah.
That stuck with me. And it's funny because when I listen to other people perform, when I listen to other violinists, I now start to hear some of that information. I hear people who are more uptight or more loose, and you can hear it in the way they approach their performance based on the way they move their body.
Yeah.
One of the things I think is conveyed that we often forget is how much information is encoded in the sound signal that's allowing the listener to pick up on that connection. There's all these issues. Is the information covering the score? Is the information coming from the interaction with the score? Mm-hmm. I was more recently started reading the work of Nicholas Cook in his book Beyond the Score, and he describes quite in detail something that I've always understood, which is the score is not music.
Yeah.
It's the interaction between the performer and the score and what we often forget, the environment that the performer is in. So with Roger Chaffin, my PhD advisor, we used to bring in professionals to do all sorts of learning studies and look at practice. And when we would put them on stage, I remember our professional cellist getting very frustrated about the way the chair was situated, where her cello was on stage. And we spent a lot of time moving her around the room before she felt that the sound was right. And I remember being like, okay, like this is the her ear. And I remember when the audience showed up, she was really irritated because she's like, the setup we found doesn't work the minute all people showed up. I was like, because the environment changed.
Actually, even as we were setting up to record, we had a conversation about, okay, now, you know, how much of the room am I hearing through given your, you know, position of microphone? And, you know, it changes what kind of conversation even we can have. So given all of these factors, as a violinist, why did you end up using trombones specifically in this setup?
So I wanted to use violinists, but I was in the middle of Storrs, Connecticut, and we had a professional trombonist in the lab. And he had professional trombone buddies. So as much as I wanted to use violinist because I have a better understanding, he actually made a very good case for the trombone being a good instrument for this kind of thing. So the one thing that concerned me about the trombone that differed from the violin is that with the violin, you can see the hands move and you know the pitch is connected to the finger movement. And the bow movement is equivalent to the breath. So you see the bow move. With the trombone, you can't see the breathing. Not directly without, and I didn't have the equipment to measure that. Now, I hadn't gotten a lot of
comments. I mean, you
can
certainly hear the breathing. That is...
Yeah, totally. You can totally hear the breathing. It comes across in the sound that they produce. But there's that preemptive breathing, which sometimes you hear in really good recordings, especially like when I hear cellists perform. Like there's a recording of Yo-Yo Ma playing the Bach cello suites, and you hear his fingers banging on the fingerboard.
Okay, so you chose trombone out of a convenience, which is a very important thing when defining research. That's good. And trombone also is an instrument where people are standing usually when they perform, and they do lean and move. I mean, it is part of their ancillary gesture vocabulary. So can you explain what this air conducting was? What did your non-trombonist participants do?
Yeah, so that was a real issue. So we had a lot of discussions with the musicians, performers, as well as people within our lab and people around us. And I did a lot of pilot work to find the right set of instructions, as well as finding things to make it clear. So what we told them specifically was to come in, I set them up in front of a computer, and I actually gave them instructions that were verbal instructions on the screen, and I left the room. And I put no camera there. And I told them they were not being recorded aside from the fact that they were standing on a force plate.
Okay.
And I specifically, the instruction was to use their body like a conductor to draw out the expression that they were hearing, the emotion that they were hearing in a performance. And I said, like a conductor stands in front, the conductor doesn't necessarily beat time. The conductor's trying to draw out what they want from the performance. And I said to them, you're the conductor here. You draw out from the performances what you feel that's going on here. I think other literature has also pointed to the same idea that it's part of expression and interpretation where the movement is kind of key. So the motion in itself is conveying expressive information, how I feel about the music and how I want others to see how I feel about it. They listened to the piece, they rated how expressive and how pleasant they thought it was. And when they were done, they came out. So interestingly, most people didn't choose to just stand there. They actually
moved along.
They felt a little silly. They did move along, actually, and some moved quite a bit. And I handed them actually a Wiimote to hold. And I had hoped, I had high hopes to use the Wiimote to do a motion capture on their hands, but that just didn't, the noise was too much in the accelerometer.
Yeah. It's a frustrating thing when you're trying different sensor inputs. Some work, some don't. I'm really glad the force plate was reliable. It's very brave to leave your participants on their own for this kind of thing, but it sounds like it worked out very well. Did they only hear the music once for each version, or did they hear music and then do this sort of embodiment? Like how?
Okay. So this is one of these cases where it's been a while. I think if I remember right, because I had programmed it up in MATLAB, I wanted them to hear it first.
Okay. So they had a sense of where things were going, maybe. How long were these excerpts of music? Were they like a minute long?
Actually, they were the full performance. So they ranged on average between about 3 1/4 to 3 minutes, 40 seconds. Like,
okay.
They're quite long.
Okay. So there was a lot of sort of potential for growth and change in that. The content wasn't static through the entire piece.
No. In fact, they went through the entire piece, and then I counterbalanced the orders of the songs so they would hear different music and different performers with different expressive styles. So some were more flat, some were more expressive.
Okay. So they heard the piece, and then they heard it again and moved with it. So they knew where things were going, at least, as opposed to just reacting to the music kind of as it came in. Okay. So that's that would make a big difference, I assume, in terms of how effective they could be as a conductor. Were your participants musicians, or were they people that, you know, did they have a good idea of what conductors did?
Somewhere in the paper had the exact numbers, but they were quite a few with musical experience. And in fact, musical experience, those who had experience playing an instrument, they actually rated the music as less expressive. They were more stingy with their ratings. There was going to be a trombone camp. And I had high hopes to make them do the task and compare them, because based on the ecological theory of how this occurs from a Gibsonian perspective, it should be stronger in trombonist listeners than non-trombonist listeners. So I'd hoped to get them as another sample, but it just, you know, the needs of graduating to get a PhD take over and you're like, okay, one study, let's go. Like,
we started off with this data of the trombonists on a force plate performing their music, and then you had listeners listening to those performances and engaging in air conducting while being on this force plate. So a force plate is this thing that you stand on, and you have information about how their center of mass moves as they are doing anything along with the music. So it's a two-dimensional representation of motion. What did you think you would find in the data pile that comes out of something like a force plate?
The one dimension that I could not get with this particular force plate, because it's actually a wee board, which, believe it or not, it does a pretty clean recording.
Okay.
The one dimension you cannot capture is up and down, which is, I've seen other people capture that, and it can actually provide some really interesting thing about when musicians are bobbing, likely with the beat. But so one of the advantages of having trombonists over violinists, as I wanted to do, is the violinist motion is actually going to be in between forward and back and side to side, what we call anterior, posterior, and medial lateral. So it would have required some statistical trickery like PCA analysis to separate the two components of motion. But with the trombone, it just naturally, their slide movement is forward and back. And the side to side for this particular instrument seemed to be highly related to the expressive components, which I was able to show in other papers.
Okay.
But AP, I thought the forward and back would be more related to the actual projection of the instrument. And as they move forward, as if I were on a microphone, like I can move a little forward now and my voice will get louder, and I can move a little bit back and my voice will get softer. So your forward and back motion is providing quite a bit of information relative to a mic. So it's picking up on what we call the phasing, the change between me and the mic over time. And then side to side, if I go side and then come back as I'm talking, you might actually hear my movement side to side being picked up in the mic.
Okay. So you had a microphone in front of them, maybe like a meter away or 2 meters away from their heads while standing still, or?
So we did these recordings over several, the initial recordings of the performances over several days, because I didn't want to tire them out. Yeah. And the other thing about professional musicians is when they don't like the recording, they will do it over and over and over again. So they were like, can't use that one. We're doing it again. So as we go in, or like 3 hours later, we get like two. I'm like, I guess details that you leave out of a paper, right?
Yeah, no, there's a lot we get to leave out of a paper. So,
The mic was planted in front of them. It was a Shure microphone that I had put. It was a decent one, and it was recording, I think it was about a meter, maybe 3 or 4 feet, and it was slightly to the left. I don't know why I put it there, but it was just slightly off center. I actually realized in some ways there was an advantage to having a mono mic, because the information is a little easier to deal with than a stereo mic. With a stereo mic, I would have been able actually to analyze specifically if the subject was going left or right, because that information would be provided. With a mono mic, I chose to analyze eventually velocity, because it's not which way they went, it's that they moved.
That's actually really important information to keep in mind, is that this was a mono signal that people were hearing. So they weren't even in a position to get, you know, the same amount of information about where the source was from binaural hearing. That's really key.
Right. And there's studies to support this idea that you're picking up motion from monaural sounds. Marcelo Wanderley's work as well has shown specifically by using just one mic that you're getting sound information, and specifically how, you know, the musician's movement relative to the mic. And he's able to see that in the sound signal.
Yeah.
And what he was also really cool that he did, he filtered the sounds. I can't remember. I think he used some kind of comb filter, which removed the environment. So it kind of, without the, because you get the sound. So it's not just that I'm moving. It's also in sound perception, it's the sound time it takes to bounce off the walls and come back. So he filtered that out. And what he found is when he played it back to people, people reported that the sound was like dead. It's just flat.
It's why really dry recording spaces sound so weird. There's like, there's no space. Anechoic recordings are like, oh, my back is like getting all tense now just with the idea. Okay.
Yep.
We know that there was motion information then in the sound signals that people were hearing. So besides the sort of shaping of phrasing and so on, they did have a clue, even if they weren't necessarily consciously picking it up. They did have a clue as to how the performers were moving as they were recording.
Yes.
Your listeners are there. They're listening to a performance that is captured in mono, but has a kind of through reverberation, some information about like changing location of the performance, even though it's pretty constrained. These aren't dramatic effects. They're, you know, they're small, subtle things that we're still sensitive to. And then you were measuring the same kind of anterior, posterior, and medial lateral motion, or backwards, forward, side to side sway that the listeners were engaging in as they were doing this air conducting exercise. And then you have these measurements of motion, and you need to figure out whether there's any relationships between them.
Yes.
So how did you do that?
All right. So there's a lot of different methods and there's a lot of argument in the literature over which is the best approach. So we started with this kind of a simple approach, which is one that's commonly used for cross-correlation. One of the first things that we actually did before we even started cross-correlating the data is we took the differences, so the empirical derivative. The person swaying left, it's irrelevant. It's just that they moved, which simplifies the relationship. So we're looking to see whether the two people are moving at roughly the same time. So there's a lot of issues, like, is the listener ahead? Because there's a lot of research to show that people are anticipating, for example, like if they're like tapping along with the beat, people are often ahead of the beat. Could people be swaying ahead of the performer? Could they be sometimes getting behind the performer? So when we cross-correlated the signals, we did allow certain give. We said about, I think it was like a half a beat or something like that, where we allowed the maximum to occur within that range.
Yeah. So you were looking at then trying to figure out if there were maybe, you know, peaks or valleys in this velocity of motion that sort of aligned between these two. Now, we would expect that there would be some kind of incidental alignment to occur, because if you have two signals that go up and down, they will probably sometimes go up and down together. But the question is, are they going more up and down together than would happen by just chance, right? Because these, because incidental alignment should be expected. So that requires having some idea of what could otherwise happen. And in this paper, you talk about using a surrogate data strategy where you generate these types of signals that kind of retain a lot of the qualities of the velocity sequences that you measured, and make kind of fake versions of that that are very similar but not identical. And then you see whether the alignments that you get between your actual measurements are better than what happened between either of these measurements and the surrogate data based off of these models, which I'm a big fan of, making up data or comparing these kind of relationships to sort of fake signals or fake, you know, sequences that are close to the originals on some kind of quantifiable way. That kind of simulation is a huge step up from trying to figure out statistical significant relationships based off of sort of much simpler assumptions. Because these data sequences, these time series are not simple. So I'm a big fan of surrogate data, of these very sort of hands-on numerical analysis strategies. But you decided to use a very specific way of generating these surrogate data sequences. And you used an approach that involved taking the fast Fourier transforms of these signals and then doing phase shifting on that decomposition and then recomposing them. And there was then this process to make sure that the amplitudes kind of had the right range of values as well to compose something that gave a similar quality of data, while obviously not sharing the exact temporal relationships to maybe the music or other things. Why don't you have a go? How would you describe this way of generating surrogate data?
So there's lots of methods. And I think before we go into the actual analysis, it might be useful to describe why it's necessary in part.
Sure.
So Roger Dean has argued in particular in the literature that cross-correlation methods or any correlational methods is going to be heavily influenced and could be quite spurious, depending on the degree to which the data has regularities in it, which are independent of the thing that you're trying to measure.
Yeah, yeah.
And in music, this the first regularity that you have to deal with is the meter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's going to add a lot of structure, a lot of oscillatory structure in the data, which we might need to control for. So the method of surrogates is, as you describe, you take the Fourier and then you shuffle the phase. So you keep the frequencies of the data constant, and then you want to keep the amplitudes constant. So the only thing you're changing is time. And the way I like to think about it is it's as if it's the same performer playing the piece, but you scrambled the notes on them. So it's like they're playing the same music with all the same intervals and the same, but like the rhythmicity has changed. So one of the problems you have is you can't get a performer in the lab to play over and over and over and over and over again. And then you can't have them play dozens of different pieces with all the same lengths and the same properties, because they're going to get tired. They're going to move less. They're going to move more. So by shuffling it, we're able to maintain a bunch of things constant, specifically the autocorrelation, the frequencies and the amplitudes. And then the only thing that should be different is that the timing between actions is broken.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm doing something unique at bar 75 and you're doing something unique when I played something bar 75, in fact, I went to the left and you went to the left, then we intermittently synchronized. Now, if we shuffle it and I went to the left at a different point than you went to the left, then we would not be synchronized because we broke that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to do this over and over and over again to get kind of a distribution of the relationships that could occur by chance. And then we ask, does our real measure, the real relationship between the two data points, fall outside of the 95th confidence interval of that relationship? So are these unlikely due to chance? Could they still be due to chance? Of course. But like they're outside the 95th confidence interval. Now, other people, when they get lots of performers performing, like in the work I've done with Anna Zam, is that instead of shuffling the raw time series, like I've done with this particular surrogate, they use natural surrogates. So they just repaired all the performers through a permutation with each other because their timings would all be different. But it doesn't actually preserve the same statistics that this method is preserving. So it's got some benefits in that you're not making up, as you kind of called it, fake data. You're not actually doing a simulation. You're using real data that you have on hand. But there could be other reasons why you see those relationships with natural surrogates that you might be controlling for with a Fourier surrogate.
How close are these surrogate data to the motion data that you recorded? Do they look really similar?
Yeah, so they do actually. So one of the first things in time series, as you know, is everything is first done by eye. Your eye tells you more information than any analysis can tell you.
Yeah.
So the first thing I did is when I started approaching this particular method, I actually started with the original method. I found Thiel's original phase shuffle before I found the better version that had been approved to fix some of the problems. So one of the first things I did is I just shuffled them and looked at them. And one of the first things I noticed was like, wow, they look the same. But when the peaks and valleys were completely different, and there were many places where you could see some peaks were larger than other peaks, which maintained the range of amplitudes. But so after we phase shuffle them, we take the derivative and then compare them again to compare the velocity. So I was quite comfortable in that they looked right. One of the other things that had to be done, by the way, before you even get there, is also something probably not mentioned in the paper, is that in motion capture, if the performer picked up his foot, right? You get a massive discontinuity in the data, but then the time series looks fine afterwards. So all of these things, especially from the performer's perspective, I couldn't do it for every, I cleaned up a lot of the subjects by eye as well, but for the performers in particular, I hand cleaned everything. I've removed all the discontinuities and any kind of oddities that I saw, any kind of linear shifts and those kinds of things that you might see.
Right. And so I'm guessing in that case, you smoothed over those discontinuities?
Yeah. In fact, for the foot shift discontinuities, it's a really easy thing. I cut the, you know, the one data point out that's in the middle and joined them. So you wouldn't even know. It's just a joining of the before and after they move their foot.
This was using time series at a sample rate around
34.
Okay. So it was a pretty high sample rate, 34 hertz.
Yes.
So you were interpolating like a few data points over
Very little shift. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, the frequency of interest here is everything between like, you know, half a hertz, one hertz. You know, quarter of a hertz. I mean, it's very slow movement.
Yeah. People don't jitter.
No.
At least not to this music.
No, definitely not.
But I'm curious as to how you found this surrogate data approach when they were initially designed, as I understand it, to identify data that was non-linear. The surrogacy generated process assumes that there's going to be kind of a linearity or a certain kind of quality to these time series. And this was initially developed to say, you know, whether or not your initial recording of the time series showed behavior that broke with that structure. So how did you even find this process?
So I was very fortunate to be at the University of Connecticut, and we had a bunch of dynamicists there. I started all this by actually recording my own motion and using myself as the pilot to figure out how these techniques would work. And they introduced the IAAFT specifically to examine things like Lapunov exponents and higher correlation dimensions. So can we detect, is the movement chaos?
Chaotic, but
Yeah, chaotic, Sorry, yes. So one of the things you do is you phase shuffle and you compare your actual value to whatever these other values are. But because of the way the metric works, it actually preserves all the other qualities, but shifts phase. I went through a process of pilot testing it where I was creating simulated oscillatory processes. So just like in music, time is not clock time.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's relative. It shortens, it expands like expressive timing. So that actually creates enough nonlinearity in the data where if you ran a Fourier, it would look like garbage. So when you actually try to compare two signals where you know they're correlated because you've created them that way, and then you run this analysis, it actually does a really good job of distinguishing it. Whereas in any time series with high order correlation in it, the traditional cross-correlation p-value will say everything is significant, especially when you have 5 or 6,000 data points that you're doing in a time series.
Yeah, no, that, I mean, that the p-values based off of that structure is just, that's nonsense. It is a violation of the premise of the definition of significance. Do not use exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point.
Yeah. So the surrogate in this case was really useful in that it seemed to provide the answer that I was looking for, saying, how can I show these two signals correlate while controlling for the things that we know are problematic in the series? Now, as the series gets longer and you get discontinuities, as I tried to fix, you run into these issues of stationarity and, you know, the variance is not stable over time. That's going to introduce an inflation rate with the type 1 error. But then at the time when I was doing this, there wasn't really much else to do. So when I looked deeper into the literature to find alternatives, I looked specifically at the wavelet people. And the wavelet people, they actually don't even use this type of surrogate. For example, I looked at, for some reason, the ocean people, the oceanographers, they use red noise.
Yes.
So it's all red noise simulation, which doesn't make sense for music. Our process is far more complex and the oscillations are far faster and more stable than a red noise process.
And the discontinuities are much more dramatic than what you find in oceanography research. Yeah.
And the discontinuity means that the performer is doing something specific that point, which tells you that they've changed something. They're like a phrase has changed or something. So it's meaningful.
And then
I also found other people had been applying. So I wasn't the first to do this kind of thing. I had looked in the literature, and after he had proposed this, people started using different types of phase surrogates to actually measure, say, neuronal synchrony or different kinds of measures. Because at its heart, you're still shuffling phase, and the cross correlation doesn't actually capture amplitude differences. It only captures phase relationships. So because of that, it just if you go up, I go up. It doesn't matter how much you go up. It just matters that we go up at the same time. So in that way, I figured by shuffling the phase, I was still getting the metric I wanted. But I knew at the same time that this was kind of like the best of choices that I wasn't like, Actually, initially, you'll notice that in the paper, I actually only had people listen to half of the recordings under the idea that I would use the other half of the performer's recordings as natural surrogates. But then the problem was, is when I correlated the performer movements from performance one to performance two, they were so highly correlated that when you replace one for the other, you get the same answer. So at first I was like, holy crap, it's all type one error because it's, and then I thought about it, I'm like, musical structure is the same for performance to performance. What causes high correlation from performance to performance is probably those things that the listeners are grappling onto. So that didn't work. And I was quite like, okay, that told me something too.
So let's step back. If you used your surrogate data the way it was initially designed to pick up whether or not your initial signal is nonlinear, would it distinguish this the same way as it distinguishes to the other signal that you're using in these comparisons?
Right. So the degree of linearity in the signal actually depends entirely on the type of expression. If you try to detect a nonlinearity in that signal, it comes out the more expressive it is. As the data got more and more non-expressive, what you end up finding is the signal actually goes pretty flat and you're not always able to detect. So it's a while back, but I did remember looking at these signals one by one. I remembered after the fact when I started doing this that I should have been a little bit more careful about using specific performances where they passed the nonlinearity test, because I remember one of the expressive non-expressive ones didn't.
Okay.
But the benefit of that is the more linear the signal, the surrogate method does not produce a significant effect in the cross-correlation. I simulated that to make myself feel less panicky about the kind of process of using this crazy method. Mm-hmm. And because it doesn't produce a type one error, the more linear it is, then I figured the worst thing that I'm doing is I'm just committing type two errors. I'm missing stuff, at least in the non-expressive performances.
And that's my major concern here with this approach is not that you're in danger of generating false positives, but rather there may very well be a lot of stuff that you're missing.
Yes,
just
I agree.
Because of the way in which you're generating very close surrogates, there's the potential of there being relationships between these signals that are obscured because it's very conservative, the approach that you're using. And that's a big challenge. I think it's maybe necessary at this stage of the way in which we are still figuring out how to identify intermittent synchrony. But I can imagine that that's a point of frustration and concern.
Yes. I think that was the thing sitting in the back of my head is you know, we're always so worried about making false positive results that. So one of the things I do is, especially with time series, is I always try to at the worst, I'll just miss everything and so be it. Mm-hmm. But then see, when you try to actually target more directly or try to. So for example, one way to get around stationarity issues and some of these other issues I was worried about was to use windowed cross correlation or. Yeah. Originally, what I had done was cross-recurrence analysis. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in both methods, we'll get around some of these issues in a really useful way.
Yeah.
Cross-recurrence, I didn't present because people found it too complicated and it allows too many research degrees of freedom where the cross-correlation doesn't. So people tended to believe me more with the cross-correlation. Uh-huh. But in terms of the windowed cross-correlation, you run into a really fascinating problem, which I spent quite a while on, which is the size of your window, of course, matters.
Yes, hugely.
And these are, hugely. And these are very slow processes that we're looking at. So by the time you window it, you're really talking about 60 seconds, a third of my performance to capture enough oscillation where you feel comfortable that you have something.
Yeah.
Then you run into the problem of when you run the window and you actually test the surrogates at this particular windows, let's say there's significance in some windows and not others.
Yeah.
What the heck do you do with that?
And this is the challenge of intermittency, right?
Yes.
And, you know, I can be listening to a piece of music and I can, nod along to it for 3 seconds. And that probably wouldn't get picked up in a larger measurement, right? If you're recording my relationship to it for, a minute, 3 seconds of nodding along does not seem significant. But as someone who is, listening to it, I know that there is a causal relationship, between the music and my nodding along at that moment. Yeah. So it's a really big challenge to figure out how to pick up on this stuff when the relationship can change so much. something that might be behind those significant relationships that you find between listeners and the trombonist performers might be really focused on these moments of non-stationarity, when someone changes gears, when someone suddenly does a big action, let's say with the beginning of a phrase that they've anticipated. That might be shared between those two performers, but that's not something that we can effectively describe with something that presumes a sort of a linear consistency. As with a surrogate. Now, that's actually what you want to be capturing, though, right?
Right. But it's still musically
that's
useful.
That's actually the signal.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So, you know, I mean, your testing process does allow for that relationship to come through, which is yes. Awesome. It's just... Yeah.
But I can't localize it.
Yeah.
That's the problem. I don't know why. And the thing is, yeah. As you pointed out earlier, is that if enough of those don't come through, mm-hmm. then I mm-hmm. won't pick them up.
Yeah.
It has to occur frequently enough that I can pick it up
yeah.
and distinguish it.
Yeah.
So like one or two instances might not be sufficient. But I think that what your point, and I think your point is extremely valid, is that we're capturing probably locations of big change or important mm-hmm. change from mm-hmm. at least a musical perspective. So let's say they go from the A section to the B section, and then mm-hmm. they come back to the A prime section, because this yeah. was, one of them was A, B, A, B, and the other one was through composed. Even novice listeners are used to that kind of A, B structure. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that they anticipated, especially with the closing of when he slows down to express that, you know, the next phrase is coming, they might all perk up and be ready to go.
I mean, I applaud you for finding this technique. I think it's really cool. And I think it is doing like 80% of like representing, making a good like comparison. And you've described how it's not quite what you want. And what you want is something that maybe allows these intermittent alignments to come through more clearly. But,
yes.
you know, I think this is still an ongoing big challenge for us that are trying to look at relationships between time series that come from musical behaviors. It's like, it is really hard from a statistical perspective to capture these kinds of intermittent alignments. And I totally believe that these relationships exist, as you showed, between performers and listeners, because it's in the signal and it's in what they're doing. And it's fantastic that you've shown this through this experiment.
And it's a weak effect. I mean, we're not seeing, it's a very small effect. And I think one of the things that came out of a previous study, which I think is important to note here as well, is that we did something with rocking chairs. You know, we had them aligning, you know, hearing each other's sounds. Mm. When we played music at the same time, we disrupted the synchrony between the pairs. But what's really fascinating was, not only did it disrupt the synchrony with the partner, but the synchrony with the music wasn't very high. Mm. But those who actually did synchronize, let's say, with just say the music instead of their partner, mm-hmm. it didn't take that much for them to then report that they felt more connected to their partner. So
interesting.
I think that some of these events that we see in music, and we found the same thing here, that those who seem to have this critical threshold for significance mm-hmm. with relationship with the performer seem to report here that the performance was more expressive.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think, as you described earlier, that you bob your head for a couple of seconds and lose mm-hmm. it, that may be all that's necessary to kind of
make
connect you. Yeah, yeah. That might be it.
Yeah. It's so important for the social aspects of musical behaviors. And and we've spent a lot of time talking about the stats to get us there. But this is so important for us to look at how these relationships might be sort of established between musicians and audiences, or even between musicians. We haven't even touched on the second part of the study, which is about what the trombonists did. But it shared a lot of similarity in terms of there's being, you know, strong relationships both within musicians and between them.
Which makes sense, though, because when I mirror, and I'm sure you do this as well, when you're mirroring somebody that you're playing with, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're adapting their physical movements, you're adapting their core articulations, you're trying to actually sound like them, and that's going to cause you to move like them.
Yeah. That's so important. So, okay, we've talked a lot about the time series, but there were other factors that you brought into this that you kind of referred to a bit. You looked at, the trombonists initially performed these pieces as very expressive or less expressive. You had two different performers performing the same pieces, which I think was an interesting choice. And then you're also looking between performers and listeners. What were the pieces behind some of those decisions? Like, why did you have two different performers for these pieces? What did you learn from having that design factor?
So the concern was that with one performer, one, anything you see could be artifactual, something about the way they're doing it. Two, what you're seeing here in this paper was actually the secondary point of my original plan. All I was really after in my original work was to find a way to statistically show a relationship between body movement and musical structure.
Yeah, yeah.
This was kind of the tacked on part. Well, like, okay, I think it's in the sound, and I think that the sound will convey that information. So I'm going to run these studies. And everybody said to me, that's kind of crazy. And I'm like, no, I think it's going to work. But, you know, you're the only one who always thinks these kinds of things.
Yeah, yeah.
So initially, I had multiple performers and multiple performances to actually get statistical reliability to run a different study, which we published earlier in 2017. Mm-hmm. But then by having two performers, it allows me more variation in the types of movements they had. So one of the really interesting thing is when I watch these performers play, the way they set their feet was different, which sounds like who cares. But even placing their feet different had a cascading effect of the way they use their bodies in performance. Yeah, yeah. One put both feet straight forward, which means that it opens degrees of freedom to the side to side. The other one did one foot forward and one foot at an angle. Which now balances them differently. So his motions turned out to be a little bit more circular.
Okay.
So all of these minor things started impacting the end result of the sway. But I mean, we know as performers, when we ourselves move, we know our movements are connected to what we're playing. And when we watch others, we know the same is true. So there has to be some statistical relationship there that we can show. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the thing for the two. Now the listeners... At the time at Connecticut, we had two big factions. We have the Gibsonian psychologists, and we had the traditional cognitive psychologists. And both groups were dynamicists, interestingly enough, or a lot of them were dynamicists. And the cognitive dynamicists argued more from an information processing standpoint, and the Gibsonians argued more that information in the environment, the signal, it's just a direct perception of actions, right? So. In kind of my own thing, I was like, if the Gibsonians are correct, then the listener, when they hear the sounds are connected to the movements, and therefore the sounds reflect the movements. So originally it was to test a Gibsonian hypothesis, but my reviewers did not agree that it was a test of the Gibsonian and dynamical perspectives. From the other side of the camp, the action simulation theorists, they thought that you can simulate the actions of a trombonist and therefore see the same levels of synchrony that I would see if the sound contained it. So I ended up getting a really good suggestion from someone at a conference, rerun the study, but put two microphones, one like I had it and the other one put right on the bell.
So it wouldn't have the same motion information in it. Yeah.
Right.
And see how that would come through.
They said that would more directly compare the two theories and such that if it was on the bell, it should be gone.
As long as your force sensor didn't creak.
Yeah.
So what were the biggest surprises in the results that you found?
I actually expected less overlap between the performers' movements. I thought they would be a little bit more unique, given what I had observed, especially the way they place their feet. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that came out, at least with the surrogate analysis, is when I compared within subject, it was just... You could almost substitute one movement performance for another within style. If they played normally, and part that might be my fault because I had them play two styles in a row. They did them in sets. If I went back, I would probably have them randomize the order more completely. But between styles, I actually was expecting to see the replication of like Marcelo Wanderley's work, that more expressive means more movement, less expressive means more flat movement, which is what came out. The big thing that came out of this was something that does not written in the papers at all, was actually the really interesting discussions I had with the musicians when I told them to play non-expressively. They hated it.
And they
said, non-expressive is not not expressive. They said, non-expressive is a type of expression. And based on their arguments, they kept saying, no, it's something completely different. I used that manipulation because it's been previously used in the literature. And they said, that's wrong. They said, what you should do is you should have more and less expressive. So that was one of the things that came out of these discussions, which I thought was really fascinating, because when you look at the motion, the expressive looks like the normal except exaggerated. The non-expressive looks completely differently. So I think they were right. And the question will be to actually examine that more thoroughly. So this reminded me of a study by Dan Levitin's group, where they digitally manipulated music to be more or less expressive. And their finding, if I remember off the top of my head, was in manipulations that were overly expressive, people didn't like it. And when they were under expressive, people didn't like it either. They liked the natural ones.
That was manipulating key velocity and timing variation in MIDI piano, if I recall correctly.
Yeah. That was a digital manipulation.
Yeah. And when it was just like piano roll, but locked in to constant key velocity and constant tempo, that was uncomfortable and it was boring. For those of us that spent a lot of time playing video games of a certain era, it has a familiar feel, but not the so for most people. It is a challenge to have a coherent performance. We kind of can feel like you're being robbed of just like phrasing entirely if you are trying to sort of stick close to recreating essentially the blandest version of the notes on the score.
Yes.
It's an important point to keep in mind when we're asking these things of our performers. Okay, so we've had a great time going into all the details of the work behind this research and what you know, a lot of the things that you learned in this research. But just to refresh listeners, can you give like a 1-minute summary of this project? You wrote the abstract, so I'm assuming you're going to be smoother at this than I am.
It's so much easier when you have time to write those 150-word abstracts. So we started with the idea that when people hear music, the question is, what are they hearing? And are they hearing motion information? That motion information could come from the performer. It could come from aspects of the musical score, such as the meter, or more complex metaphorical concepts like, say, a soprano singing a high C, her arms go up into the air, which all that is now being part of the musical relationship between sound and movement. So if people are listening and asked to move with music, will they reflect just kind of their own unique understanding, or will they actually be reflecting information that's being conveyed to them by the performer? So will they move like the performer? Because music is both the performer, the score, and the other metaphorical elements. And when we compare those, yes, we do see a relationship between the movements of the listener and the performer who's creating those sounds. And when we ran the study again with the performers performing with recordings of other people who made those recordings, they're adjusting them in such a way where they're actually moving to keep aligned more than we would expect by chance or even just overlap from the musical reasons. So I think the summary statement here is that when we're listening to music, we're picking up on information maybe related to movement. And we need to think a little bit more about the relationship between movement, expression, and music to help understand what musical communication is.
Yeah, it's such a cool question. And it's awesome that you found an experiment that actually let you get there to get at in between all these pieces of what might be encoded in score information and what comes through interpretation and what is being communicated, even through recording contexts, and then actually to get participants to do something fun like air conducting. Like, you've got a lot of really cool pieces here in this study. I loved it. But in terms of your experience coming at this question as a musician, did you learn things about music, like in the process of doing this work?
So distinguishing between metaphorical motion and motion created by the performers almost seems like a moot point at sometimes. You can't move in such a way to produce the sounds without having that information about what you want to produce. So your interpretation is key, but it gets harder and harder to unpack of actually there is no source attribution. It's all coming from this specific one interaction. So I got more of an appreciation that music is really the combination of the performer interacting with their score and interacting with their audience, much more than I think more traditional ways in music cognition we think about it, which is score through performer to listener. I really think it's an interactive system. And the other big change that I had in this process of going through this is music became much more of an understanding of a social process than a cognitive process to me. So it's so much more social. And sometimes when we studied from a music cognition perspective, we forget that the whole point of music is to not only convey emotion and expression, but to actually bind people together and make them feel part of a group.
Yeah. This opportunity to engage physically in music is such a cool way of getting at those kinds of relationships. In looking at listener research, I think we should spend a lot of time thinking about how listeners move and how listeners get to participate in music and give back to a performer, whether or not the performer is, let's say, physically present to receive that. The paradigm of working with recorded music, it's easy to forget that this is such a new way of making music in terms of culturally, historically. It's so anomalous. It's so exceptional. It is not a standard. It is a weird variation on something that has been fundamentally defined by people that are present together.
Yeah. And when we go to classical concerts and people sit there like stones,
yeah,
it would be so nice to get up and let people move around a little bit. They might actually feel, you might get younger people in the audience, you know?
Yeah. It's a relief, at least for me, who's someone who's a bit of an impulsive mover. For me, it's such a relief to go to different kinds of concerts and actually be allowed to make a little motion, to make a little sound. So this research, you know, does a lot of cool stuff in terms of getting at an important question in music cognition research. It does some pretty cool like experimental design stuff. It does some really cool data analysis stuff. What do you see this leading to? What kind of work do you want this study to be supporting?
So I think one of the things that I've always been after, at least in the work that I've done with Roger, as well as the work, this work in particular, is that I'm personally interested in more natural settings, more natural, full natural performances, as opposed to you run into these like little clips. You play a little bleep, 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 and you say, that's my musical clip. And it's kind of like, okay, that's not music. Someone has to get into it. Someone has to really experience it. Someone has to be able to see the bigger picture. And that doesn't occur right away. And I'd like to see more naturalistic use, but also try to take more account into the system in general. Think about the performer, the listener, and the environment in which we're doing these tasks. Because even from this idea of, look, when I put people in the room alone, I make sure to specifically say no one is watching you, because the idea that we run in experiments where, you know, we put people in rooms and we have them click buttons, and that's very constraining. And it doesn't yield a more natural reaction. So, but as you know, the more naturalistic our data becomes, the harder the analysis is.
Oh, that was a laugh cry. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just to get back to data analysis stuff, is this a technique you'd recommend to other people? Or are there refinements that you are interested in bringing in to maybe the design of surrogate data or, you know, strategies of interpretation? Or how are you feeling about this now?
So as I feel about everything that I do, I want to retract everything and stick it under the pillow and never look at it again.
No, I really like it. I really like it.
No, I appreciate that. But I mean, there's always this anxiety that goes along with trying new things. Yeah. I think one of the things that I came across in particular was what might be a way in which to take the performance. So for example, in the piece that I had more well-defined structure, A, B sections, would I actually have benefited from maybe running surrogates within those particular units?
Yeah.
The other thing is what I like the idea of the surrogates. In the future, I would not have repeated this with cross correlation. So this was a compromise that I made to make this point as clear as I can. I think alternative methods are really useful. I want to start moving more into joint recurrence quantification analysis to get at some of these issues. But music still presents a huge problem in that if I'm listening and moving, or if we're playing together, right? If we're playing together, our timing is the same. But if I'm just listening to you, my timing is not yours. And therefore, the lag is moving around. And that's the problem that keeps me up at night. It's like, we may be stable at these points. I may be behind you. I may be ahead of you. And that's moving around. And cross-recurrence analysis captures that. And there are actually a whole method applied for surrogate methods that's like IAFT, but a little bit more refined for cross-recurrence and other recurrence methods. I think that's particularly useful. But I think any method where we start to establish what chance synchrony might be is useful. And I think this is one approach. Others are perfectly feasible. And I think we want to compare them. Talk about what I like to see in the future is almost like conceptual replications with different methods thrown in and see if we start getting different pictures, because each time you run something, God knows what you're going to get.
Yeah. I think we need more experimentation when it comes to breaking apart or figuring out sort of what information is in these signals and capturing those blips, whether or, you know, opportunities for alignment, we will get more refined, I think, with time. We will get more refined in being able to pick up intermittent alignment or other intermittent synchrony, get at those cool pieces of the signals. But that will involve being able to make comparisons, as you say, of different strategies. So yeah, this is an important piece, I think, in that journey towards more consistency and maybe strategies that really work for music. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. I guess we really won't know until we kind of all throw the pasta at the wall and see what sticks.
You know, well, we talked about this earlier, but this approach seems to be conservative in terms of its capacity to pick up this kind of intermittent alignment. And that's not a bad standard to maintain. You know, as we're trying to do this shaky refinement of, you know, representations of alternatives of, you know, or whatever, development of our surrogate data and that sort of stuff, starting from a position of being more cautious, particularly when dealing with this very complicated data and more naturalistic performances of musical behaviors, at least it helps us stand up to the skeptics by holding our own statistics to an ambiguously high, but still very high standard for picking up significance. So, you know, it's the right way to lean while we're still hesitant about exactly what it is that we're picking up.
Yeah, yeah. And the challenge also moving forward in these kinds of work is thinking about how to design studies for these kinds of analyses a priori as opposed to after the fact.
Yeah.
I knew walking into this that I had these things at my disposal, which meant I wasn't scared to collect 3 minutes worth of data and...
Yeah. 3 minutes certainly gives you a lot more to work with than one. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Alex, for coming on and talking about your work. I hope, listeners, that you've enjoyed our discussion. And sorry if we went on the data analysis deep end for a bit, but hopefully, you know, there is enough there for you to grab onto. And, you know, if people have any specific questions about what we talked about, there's going to be information in the show notes to the specific papers we sort of touched on. And I don't know about you, Alex, but I love talking about data analysis. So we should keep the conversation going even on online or wherever if people want to get into that.
I totally agree.
Yeah. We spent so much of our lives learning this stuff. We might as well share it, right? So that's it for this episode of the So Strangely podcast on recent research in music science. If you like what you hear and you want to support the podcast, the number one method is to review it on iTunes or wherever you are listening, and also share your favorite episodes or talk about this stuff on social media. Help us become part of the music science conversation online. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can follow the podcast on Twitter, So Strangely Pod. You can find us on Facebook, and also check out the website and blog, sostrangely.com. And if you are a music science academic with your hands on a new publication that you think other people should hear about, we're still doing recommendation style episodes. So you can come on the podcast yourself and talk about good research and join us in an interview with the lead researcher of that particular paper. That's been really fun to do that kind of interview too. It also means that the conversation doesn't just revolve around what I care about in music science. And so if you're interested in that, you can get in touch through any social media or drop us a line at sostrangely.com/contact or email me at finn@sostrangely.com. Thank you for listening. And until next time, keep digging into how and why music sometimes behaves so strangely.
Sometimes behave so strangely. Sometimes behave so strangely. So strangely. So strangely. So strangely. So strangely. So strangely.